This is Car Expert.
So MG finished in 11th position. These really are new heights for a Chinese brand in Australia.
Surely we've reached peak Commodore. I can't see how the prices can be sustained.
They're V8 numbers from a few years ago, coming from an engine that is the same size as what was in my mum's Golf.
G'day, my name's Mandy Turner. A big hello to Scott Colley this week.
G'day, Mandy.
And William Stopford.
Hey, Mandy.
Now, you've been driving an interesting little car this week, Will, the Yaris Cross. What were your first impressions?
Well, first impressions, I love the color brown on a car. It's one of those colors that a lot of people don't like, but inexplicably seems to be offered like every year by multiple manufacturers. This is the Yaris Cross I've got is a GXL hybrid all-wheel drive, and it is painted in some unholy marriage of brown and beige and tan. They call it latte, and it actually kind of does look like a very milky coffee. It's been getting some very mixed reports from people, but ultimately I think the Yaris Cross itself is a pretty good looking car. So as I said, I've got the GXL all-wheel drive hybrid. Well, it just went back the other day, which comes in at $34,990 before on-road costs. It's an interesting thing because if you step inside a Yaris Cross, if you've been inside the current generation of Yaris, it is virtually identical inside. Maybe not the nicest interior at that price point, but there's nothing else in this part of the market that has hybrid powertrain and all-wheel drive. And despite the presumably extra weight that an all-wheel drive system adds, this thing, no matter how I drove it, just got really good fuel economy. I did my usual fuel economy test loop, and I got like 4.3 liters per 100 kilometers. And then I just kept driving it for the rest of my time with it, and it didn't crack 4.5. Like, this thing is genuinely fuel efficient. Wouldn't say it's the most inspiring thing to drive or to look at or to sit in, but certainly it is a Toyota, so it's well screwed together, it's reliable, and with that hybrid powertrain, it's got sensational fuel economy. So I think it will do well. I think it's already, in this past month, it's gotten up to second in sales in that segment, and I'm sure with time it'll probably topple the Mazda CX-3 because it's a Toyota, and that's what Toyotas tend to do. They're rarely second. Fortuna aside. I think we're going to be seeing more and more of these on the roads. I think that the catch is, though, there's a lot of other cars in this segment. So people who are looking for a light SUV have more choices than ever. So it's really worth checking out everything that's out there.
Will, at one point there, it sounded like you were just aggressively ambivalent towards the car. It was sort of, is it attractive? Not really. Is it nice inside? Sort of. Does it drive well? Is it a car? That I can confirm. It sure is. That aside, I'd like to rewind to the very, very start of what you said. What do you mean you like brown on cars?
I love brown colored cars. But it's a very shade dependent color, right? I mean, I love the color brown. I've got like brown shoes, brown leather jacket, various brown things. So I like the color, but there are some bad browns. I don't know if you'd even really call it brown or beige or tan. I mean, I guess latte is indeed.
It's almost a sort of khaki, isn't it?
It's a bit weird. And also the Yaris Cross is kind of a little, I think a couple of people who looked at it said, oh, it's a bit dorky, isn't it? Because the wheels kind of feel lost in the wheel arches, and it looks a little, it kind of just looks like a little jacked up little hatchback. So it's not the cutest thing in the segment, at least not in this spec. I mean, if you go up to like an urban spec with the nicer wheels and not this color, it's a better looking thing.
Okay. I'm looking forward to reading your review very soon, Will. It's time for this week's news. And, Will, the 2021 BYD Han, an electric sedan coming from China, is going to be arriving in Australia.
Yes. Yeah, so the companies at BYD, they market themselves as Build Your Dreams, and it is an and initial is not an acronym. I always go to say BID, but it's BYD. The Han is an electric sedan from them that has some pretty impressive performance claims. It's got a claimed range of over 600 kilometers and a claimed 0 to 100 kilometer an hour sprint time of just 3.9 seconds. So this is very different from the Chinese cars that have been making serious inroads here. So we've seen the Chinese come in at the lower end, you know, with light hatchbacks like the MG3, with cheap small SUVs like the MGZS here, LDV utes, et cetera, et cetera. But what we haven't seen, and you'll notice this if you go to China, there's a lot of companies selling premium electric vehicles. NIO is one of them. Roway, which is part of SAIC, they've got the Marvel X, which is a very impressive looking electric crossover. But BYD is another one. So they've got a range that's all named after different Chinese dynasties. So there's the Han, there's the Song, there's the Qin, and I think there's a couple of other ones as well. So they've got a wide range of electric vehicles. So these use lithium iron phosphate technology for the batteries. And the Han is effectively a Chinese rival for the Tesla Model S. So it will be coming here as part of a four-car range. So with the Tang, which will be a plug-in hybrid SUV, and a smaller sedan called the Qin, spelled Q-I-N. So a company called EV Direct is going to be bringing these BYD products to Australia, and they will be selling their cars through their website. So instead of, you know, BYD themselves opening up traditional bricks and mortar showrooms, EV Direct will be handling sales of these. And basically what the company's CEO, Luke Todd, has said is that you won't need to shop around. You can go to one website. There'll be multiple vehicles that'll be on the market, and you'll be able to research, compare, and check which vehicles you like, and then make an educated decision. So it is very interesting. So BYD will be getting its foothold in the market through EV Direct, and that will allow Australians to basically have more choice when it comes to electric cars, because we don't, other than Tesla and, you know, the MG with the ZSEV, Hyundai with the Ioniq, and Kona Electric, and Kia with the Niro, and Nissan with the Leaf. Now that I actually list them out, it sounds like we have a lot, but I assure you, it's just the way I was wording it. There's not a massive amount of electric vehicles on sale here, especially not when you compare it to China, where like basically every company has at least one electric vehicle, sometimes multiple, compared to the US, compared to Europe, which has already gotten electric vehicles that we're going to be waiting a little while for, like the Volkswagen ID3. So I'll be very curious to see how BYD goes, because a lot of Chinese brands have come and gone over the years, but the current crop that we've got here at the moment, like MG, like GWM, etc., they've been steadily growing. In the case of MG, growing really rapidly. But as I said before, they're at the lower end of the market. They're offering a budget alternative to your traditional sedans and utes and hatchbacks and that. So I'd be very curious to see if this potentially budget alternative to Tesla, and we don't know what the pricing will actually be like just yet, if a Chinese brand, obviously with the help of EV Direct, can take off in this part of the market in Australia.
And Scully, the 2023 Ford Ranger Raptor is going to be launching with a petrol V6, and it looks like it's coming this way.
It looks like all the things that people complained about with the old Ranger Raptor, or should that be the current Ranger Raptor, are going to be answered with the new Ranger Raptor, which is very exciting because we like the current Ranger Raptor, but we don't love the engine. And this car was spied testing in the US alongside the Ford Bronco Warthog, which is like the tougher Bronco Raptor, essentially. It was right-hand drive, so fit for the Australian market. It had an exhaust that would work in Australia, so different to the exhaust they use in America on the Raptors, which is a side exit. And it had a petrol engine. And as Car Expert reported last year, before the launch of the Bronco and the launch of the Bronco confirmed, we're expecting the new Ranger to have a 2.7-litre EcoBoost Nano V6. In the Bronco, it pumps out about 230 kilowatts of power and 540 newton meters of torque. And it sort of looks like that's what's going to show up in the next Ranger Raptor, which is really exciting because, yeah, I know a lot of people in Australia love how the Ranger Raptor looks. It's got a really sophisticated suspension system. but it doesn't have an engine that feels kind of burly enough to be a Raptor properly. So if Ford does end up getting this V6 in Australia, which is what looks likely based on all the facts that are in front of us right now, Ford Australia hasn't actually confirmed it, it could really sort of expand the appeal of that car. For its part, Ford Australia said it has no comment on the next generation Raptor or the next generation Ranger for that matter, but it did say that the Australian team plays a central role in the design and engineering of the Ranger and the Everest, which is one of the reasons that we're really hopeful this petrol will come to Australia, because the platform the new Ranger and by extension the new Amarok will be built on has a lot of Australian input. And given this car is being designed from day one with the Raptor platform, it's not being designed after the car's been around for a while and facelifted, we're really hoping that in those plans is that Australia will get the full range of stuff that is also expected to be offered in the USA. I am curious, guys, does the idea of a petrol Raptor excite you? Because it excites me.
Yes, absolutely yes. Look, diesel four cylinders obviously serve their purpose in utes. I don't like the sound of them from the outside. I hate when somebody pulls up outside my building and I can just hear it clattering away. but when we're talking about a performance ute, I've always been a little bit underwhelmed with the outputs that the Ranger Raptor diesel currently puts out. And an engine like this is exactly what the Raptor needs. And also, we've seen that there's really no price cap to what people are willing to pay for a dual cab ute. We keep seeing more and more high-end models there, obviously with the current Ranger Raptor being one. So it wouldn't surprise me if Ford charges more for this when it comes out, perhaps considerably more. And it wouldn't surprise me if in turn people actually were willing and quite happily paying more for it.
Mike Costello is joining us a little bit early in this news story. Hello, Marco.
G'day, Mandy.
And also we're going to join in with Paul Marrick as well. G'day, Paul.
Hello, team. It's a very full podcast today.
It really is. we're going to mainly talk to you, Paul, for this story. It's about something that has consumed your interest for the past couple of weeks, and that is some very rare Holdens that were auctioned and sold this week. I suppose we've grown accustomed to seeing classic cars fetch some insane auction prices, but a pair of modern Holdens have really turn the table. What were they and why are they so special?
Okay, so a little bit of history. HSV GTSR W1, it was, I guess, the pinnacle of HSV in Australia. It was the most powerful car they'd ever produced. It was fastest, you know, it was everything. It had an LS9 supercharged V8 under the bonnet, and they produced 275 for Australia. There were four pilot cars, and then there was a handful that went to New Zealand as well. But behind the scenes, there was actually four utes that were produced as well. So these were W1 utes, and they were just offered to loyal HSV customers, the most loyal customers they had. They weren't made available to the public, and we don't know how much they originally cost. Some are saying it was around the $300,000 mark. So pretty expensive proposition. Another two of them were created by people outside of HSV. So I think these were perhaps HSV's other customers that still wanted a W1 ute but weren't selected for the for that privilege. The other car was the final production car to roll down the line at Holden, but little caveat there. So it was the final VIN number, but it technically wasn't the final car to roll down the production line. There were a couple of other cars ahead of it that were used as pre-selections for the ceremonial last car to roll down the production line that Holden currently owns. So the story behind the last car, rather, was that it was a Holden employee that used insider knowledge to track down where this car was heading. They then called the dealer. It was a Melbourne dealer that had that car as stock and said, I want that car. Please leave all the stickers on it and don't register it. He then sat on that car for a couple of years. Now, the red SSV Redline, the final VIN number, sold for a ridiculous $750,000. And I say it's ridiculous because it started at 50 grand, and I thought it would maybe hit 100 grand and that would be that. I was watching the auction live and the numbers I was hearing were just seriously insane. And then the W1 ute finished for $1,050,000.
Crazy.
It is insane.
Absolutely crazy.
So the cool story behind the ute is that the winner of that auction is the guy that runs a company called LMCT Plus. They do car raffles, and the car's actually going to be raffled off as an auction prize. So someone is going to walk away with one of the rarest cars in Australia, but also an item that's worth $1 million. So it is absolutely insane.
So, Paul, we've been talking about this a bit in the office this week, and my ears just pricked up when you said a Holden employee was able to intercept the last Commodore sold and get it before the general public could. How does that work, and why was that employee the lucky one and not another employee the lucky one who actually worked out where this priceless car was going?
Yeah, so my understanding is the backstory behind it is that that employee plus an engineer were at a pub, and the engineer said, well, you know, why don't you actually look up where the car with the last VIN number actually went? And he used that system that apparently is available to Holden employees to figure out where the car was going. It is a little bit shady, though, because he's made a, you know, almost $700,000 profit on this when, you know, anyone else could have done the same but didn't. And I don't know whether that's entirely good. But anyway, that's what's called initiative, Scott. You're learning, hopefully.
Sorry, I'm just busy Googling the system for when the last car expert Commodore rolls off the line.
Paul, we've seen the bubble burst in the past with some classics like the VW Combi, the Ford Falcon GT fetching hundreds of thousands of dollars. Do you think it will also burst with these rare modern-day Holdens?
Surely we've reached peak Commodore. I can't see how the prices can be sustained. Mind you, you look at our future. We're going down the path of electric cars. You know, V8 sedans, wagons, utes are going to feel like a thing of the past in 10 or 20 years' time. 10 or 20 years' time when everyone's driving around in silent electric cars. So perhaps they will continue going up in value. Maybe we haven't reached the peak yet, but I do know that as these cars are disintegrated down the track and people crash them and get rid of them, that we will see less on the road and that will simply drive out demand.
I'm assuming that you're going to buy a ticket for the LMCT Plus raffle, right? And if you did, we know what we could do with it.
I'll be buying tickets for the raffle. If I did win it, I would be driving it. That's definitely one thing I'd be doing. And I wouldn't be selling it. I'd be holding on to that because it is quite a special car.
Fair enough. All right, Paul, thank you so much.
No, thank you, Mandy.
And lastly, Mike Costello talks the first month of 2021's new car sales figures, the V-Facts. It seems the market is recovering with another increase this month over last January, Moco.
That's exactly right, Mandy. We saw a nice little sort of uptick at the end of 2020, the kind of hockey stick effect on the graph, as it's called. And we saw the same thing replicated in January of this year, mostly driven by private buyers. So sales of new cars climbed 11% in January over the same month in 2020 to a shade under 80,000 units. So that's according to this week's VFACTS data. And every single state and territory was up by between 2% or 39%. So there were no regions that were down across the country. The sales jump came almost entirely from the private buyer market, which was up 25%, whereas business fleet sales actually fell 1%. So this is not big companies buying lots and lots of vehicles. This is individual mums and dads buying their next cars that's doing this. The jump is even more noticeable, I think, when you factor in we're hearing about so many stock shortages from across, you know, the industry at the moment, mostly because of factory lags due to COVID overseas. So the fact that most brands are struggling to get stock and yet sales are really bouncing back kind of says a lot about the pent-up demand that we saw last year. In a more macro sense, SUVs accounted for about 52% market share, which is staggering. Passenger vehicles other than SUVs, so we're talking about sedans, hatches, coupes, convertibles, and people movers, owned 23% share, and light commercial utes and vans a further 22% share. So pretty interesting stuff.
I am super keen to hear how MG went because I just keep on the increase every month.
So I'll give you a rundown through the brands here, and MG was right up there. So Toyota, as always, was market leader ahead of Mazda. Mazda was actually up 27% into second place. Hyundai was up 9% and finished third. Kia nabbed fourth spot ahead of Mitsubishi and Ford. And rounding out the 10 were Nissan, Subaru, Volkswagen, which was down because of lack of Golf and Tiguan supply, and Mercedes-Benz finishing 10th. And right behind Mercedes-Benz is MG. So MG finished in 11th position with 2,408 sales, up 162%. Now, these really are new heights for a Chinese brand in Australia. And not only did it finish 11th overall, but it actually was the number one brand in the light car segment and the number two brand in the small SUV segment with the ZS. And on the Chinese brand theme, there were actually multiple Chinese brands inside the top 20. Both LDV and GWM, which includes Havel and Great Wall vehicles, also finished in the top 20. So another bumper month for Chinese cars. In fact, Chinese cars outsold cars from a lot of other markets, including Germany and the United States. So, you know, these geopolitical wars that we're having at the moment aren't reflected in car sales.
Yeah. Seeing a lot more of those MG ZSs getting around town lately as well. How did all the models go?
So in terms of models, it was kind of the usual suspects up the top of the tree. You had the Hilux, the Ranger and the RAV4, 1, 2, 3, which we've basically come to expect with every single month. Mazda CX-5 and Toyota Corolla rounded out the top five. That means that Toyota had the number one car, SUV and commercial. Again, nothing particularly interesting in that. Top 20 list has 5 utes, 11 SUVs and 4 passenger cars. To be honest with you, there weren't a lot of changes over the normal month, aside from the fact that the MG3 was the number one light car and the MG ZS was the number two small SUV. The usual suspects dominated their segments, as we have come to expect.
Moco, SUVs are obviously doing crazy numbers as per usual. Were there any passenger car segments that showed signs of growth at the start of 2021, or is it all bad news on that front?
No, so it's actually a really good question that you asked, Scully. And we did see some growth across some passenger segments. So microcars were up 64%. Nearly all of that's down to the Kia Picanto. We live in a world now where a Toyota Yaris costs 30 grand. And so for a lot of people, a tiny car like a Kia Picanto that's 16 or 17K with a touchscreen is actually a pretty appealing proposition. So micro grew. Light cars also grew. This is the segment that's dominated by the MG3, but also the Kia Rio, Mazda 2, Toyota Yaris, Suzuki Swift. So we saw a real spike at the sort of entry-level end of the market compared to what we saw last year. Things were very much a different story in the small car space and the medium car space, both of which plummeted. Large cars were up slightly, but off an extremely low base. So you're really seeing those mid-level passenger cars in the small and medium segments being completely cannibalized by SUVs, but clearly there's still an appetite for vehicles right at the bargain basement end of the market, under 20 grand, because you can't get an SUV for under 20 grand new, but you can still get micro and light cars. So that's really where I guess there's still a vestige of power left in the passenger car space.
I've been following the VFAX every month and watching the small SUV segment in particular, because I keep waiting for the Hyundai Kona, the Kia Seltos, to finally overtake the Mitsubishi ASX, because that ASX is just so long. And now along comes the MG ZS sitting at number two in absolute striking distance. So I feel like MG is posing a serious threat, not only to Korean brands, but also to some of the Japanese brands like Mitsubishi, who, you know, tout their, you know, low, low prices and driveway deals.
Well, Mitsubishi is being hurt because rental sales and government fleet sales are well down still, and Mitsubishi is quite reliant on fleet sales. And the point you make is really good, Will. In fact, I was we do a thing on the site called Ask an Expert, where readers can email us in with their purchasing questions. And there was a person emailed in today saying they had 25 grand and wanted a small SUV. And if you go on the company's websites and price up a Hyundai Venue or a Suzuki Vitara or any of these real entry-level SUVs, they're all 26, 27 grand for an auto. Whereas the MG's 22 drive away with a 7-year warranty, and it may not be the flashiest thing under the sun, but for a lot of people, it is fast becoming the only option that you can go for in a certain budget. So it's not surprising to me that it's doing so well. Ditto the Havel H2, which is another Chinese small SUV that's also growing at a massive rate of knots, alongside, you know, new entrants like the Ford Puma and Skoda Kamiq. But yeah, look, that Mitsubishi still reigns supreme, but, you know, as time goes by, I think that will probably eventually change.
I've been seeing
Moco, it's interesting you mentioned just how sharply priced the MG cars are, because when we spoke to MG last year, it was earlier in the pandemic, but they essentially said the MG3's success is because it's so cheap, people see it as an alternative to public transport. It's essentially a car that people go, I want a car because I don't want to ride the bus, but I want to spend the absolute minimum possible. And because it's quite big, it looks quite sharp, and it's got some good flashy specs on paper, the MG3 fills that role, you know, better than essentially anything else. So it's interesting to see that approach has worked also with the ZS.
Well, it's kind of a bit like what the Hyundai XL was in the 90s. Like, it's dirt cheap and it's not terrible. And like, I know that sounds like a low criteria, but for a lot of people, that's really all they want. The used car market at the moment has been beset by supply shortfalls. You know, used car wholesalers are struggling to get stock. When you don't have a lot of something, basic supply and demand means the prices go up. So used cars are at record highs at the moment. So you're not saving a ton buying a used vehicle either. So it's the perfect time for these aggressively priced brands that don't have a lot of legacy but do have pricing on their side to really capitalize. And unsurprisingly, we're seeing that. I mean, if you look across other segments, the GWM Ute from China is killing it. The LDV Ute and Deliver 9 van, both killing it. You know, the MGHS mid-sized SUV doing really well. You know, Havel's got a lot of product coming down the pike that we're aware of this year in the form of two SUVs. So, you know, we are seeing a bit of a change. And I think, you know, while brands like Toyota and Mazda keep their prices high, it's only going to give them even more opportunity.
I don't want to give MG a pass for not including any active safety technology in the MG3, but you're right. When you do think of it as the modern day equivalent of, you know, a 95 Hyundai XL with a low driveway price, a lot of people who are buying these, it's their first car. They're coming out of potentially an older used car. It certainly doesn't have any active safety technology, and perhaps maybe only has two airbags. So it's still an upgrade in that respect. Although, I mean, it is worth pointing out the MG3 doesn't actually have a safety rating from ANCAP, and the last safety record is from Euro NCAP about 10 years ago, because it is that old. It might look fresh on the outside still, but it is that old. And it was, a 3-star rating. So not the safest thing on the market, but is it safer than a lot of used cars out there? Potentially.
Well, it's also worth mentioning that they refused to give a suppressed car MG3 to test, so they obviously don't think much of it. Just to wrap up this VFAX segment, I'll just flag a couple more sort of macro things. So from the top five segments of sales in terms of market share, mid-sized SUVs, 4x4 utes, small SUVs, small cars and large SUVs made up 73.3% of the market. So there are about 20 vehicle segments that the Federal Chamber carves the market up into, but five of those segments, the dominant five segments, make up 3/4 of all vehicles sold. So when people say, you know, why don't we see more content on big sedans or sports coupes or things, when you look at the market, almost everybody buys one of five types of vehicle and the rest kind of get lost. And I think that figure really reinforces that. There were 47,500 petrol vehicles sold, up 4%, nearly 25,000 diesel sold, up 19% on the back of the continued ute boom. And we've seen the Australian government expand the instant asset write-off policy that it's got to 2022. So there's going to be a lot more tradies buying utes in perpetuity, as it seems. 5,200 hybrids, up 51% over the record 2020 haul, so they keep growing at a rate of knots. Taking out Tesla, which doesn't tell us its figures, frustratingly enough, there were 296 EVs sold. That's up at nearly 150% on last year, and 158 plug-in hybrids, up 80%. So those green vehicles off a low base are definitely growing. And just the final one that I made in the story was, I sort of alluded to this before, but the main sources of vehicle imports were Japan, Thailand, Korea, the top three, and then China in fourth, ahead of Germany and the USA. So that's the first time China's been number four, as far as I'm aware. Wow. Got a quote here from the chief executive of the Federal Chamber of Automotive Industries, Tony Weber. That's the peak body for all the car brands. During the past 3 months, sales had increased by 12% compared to the corresponding period 12 months earlier, he said. January sales numbers are indicative of positive consumer confidence in the domestic economy. With attractive interest rates and a range of other economic indicators encouraging consumption, we hope to see this trend in new vehicle purchasing continue through 2021. So based on all of what we're hearing, once stock starts to pick up again in the next few months, it should be a bumper year for Australian car companies.
Moko, before you go, I think it is worth mentioning that this is the last time we're going to be talking about Holden in VFAX sales, because it recorded zero for the first time, and that's it for the brand.
Great point, Scully. And indeed, it recorded zero sales. So obviously, it's no surprise that Holden has disappeared and the brand's now gone, at least from a sales perspective, though it continues to service its vehicles. But it still had, you know, dealers that had new vehicles in stock that were continuing to be sold off. Clearly, there was a directive from GM to get rid of all those vehicles by the end of 2020, because lo and behold, the first month of 2021, a big fat zero Holden sold. That would obviously be a first since 1948, that not a single Holden has been sold in a month. And I think it's official now that we can wave goodbye to that brand, which, you know, again, that story's been told quite widely, but nevertheless, it's an interesting milestone, I suppose.
Certainly is. You can read the full VFAX report now up at Car Expert, and we thank you, Mike Costello.
And as always, head over to the story and ask me a question in the comments and I will answer you. I might be a bit slow, but I will answer you eventually.
Manic. That is one word that Scott Colley has described the small SUV, the 2021 Mercedes-AMG GLA 45S. Now, Scully, before we go into why it's so manic, I'm a bit scared to ask how much it is.
Yeah, this is not a cheap car, as it turns out. Not that any Mercedes really is, but the GLA 45 was always, I say always, the first generation car was a $90,000-odd proposition. It was sort of a direct rival to the Audi RS Q3. The new car is bigger. It's built on Mercedes' MFA2 platform, which is the same one that's used under the A-Class and the A45. And it's got a lot more tech, but the price rise isn't the usual little incremental price rise we often see. The car that we tested actually cost $116,295 before on-road costs. the list price is $107,035 before on-roads. And the extra money went into metallic paint, which was $1,500, the aerodynamics package, which is a wing and some flicks on the side for $3,000, the high-performance seat package, which is $3,290, and the innovation package, which is a head-up display and AR navigation. For $1,500.
Hang on, head-up display is not standard?
Yeah, so at risk of diving in too quickly, a lot of the stuff on the GLA that is optional I personally don't think should be, because at $107,000, it's not a cheap car. And things like the basic seats, for example, ATCO actually commented on when he did a track review of one of these AMGs, they just don't do enough to hold you in place, whereas the performance seats are fantastic. They're so comfortable and so grippy. But they really shouldn't be a $3,300 option on what is meant to be the most manic little SUV Mercedes sells. So, yeah, I think we're probably getting off on a bad foot for what is quite a good car, yes. But it is expensive. And on list price, it's actually more expensive than a Porsche Macan GTS with all the options fitted, although no Porsche ever leaves the factory without about 20 grand's worth of options. So I know that levels out. But it's really serious money for what is a car that shares its bones with a $50,000 A180, which it takes some mental gymnastics to get over that. I definitely think you've got to do some jumping in your mind to wrap your head around how Mercedes has made an A-Class into something so expensive. But then you drive it and you realize that it is pretty special.
Yeah, this was going to say, we should get onto the positives now. Why did you call it manic?
It's manic for a number of reasons, but I mean, the main one is the engine. This is actually the first proper AMG, the first like top of the line AMG I've driven. I've driven an A35, but not anything 45 or 63. And the engine in this car is so impressive. I mean, we see a lot of really heavily turbocharged performance four-cylinder engines out there. Everything in the Volkswagen group that is quick essentially has one. BMW's gone down that path now as well with the M140i, and Kia and Hyundai don't necessarily do a 2-liter displacement, but all of their performance stuff is pretty much 4-cylinder turbocharged as well. So on paper, there's nothing particularly special about what's in the A45, but then you read some of the details and this is actually a clean sheet of paper ground up design. It doesn't share any parts with the 2-liter engine that was in the previous A45 and GLA 45. It's running a crazy 2.1 bar of boost, which I assume means that if something goes wrong, you end up with like a black hole around the car because it is running at such high pressure. And it's making, and this is a 2-liter engine, remember, 310 kilowatts of power and 500 newton meters of torque, which are just like their V8 numbers from a few years ago, coming from an engine that is the same size as what was in my mum's Golf. so it really, really is an impressive engine. And then Mercedes couples that with a really, really clever all-wheel drive system as well that can send torque from the front axle to the rear axle, and then once it's at the rear axle, send it to the outside wheel to get the car to rotate. So, yeah, it's got some really impressive technical specs, and the way that plays out in the real world is that it's just like a rally car on stilts, basically.
So how does it ride then in that case?
Much better than I expected. One of the criticisms of the previous generation, anything A45, CLA, GLA, A45. I realize I'm now just shouting numbers and letters at you because that's how modern naming works.
Bingo.
But they were criticized for their ride because it was really, really firm. This car has quite clever adaptive dampers, and it's got a really clever adaptive drivetrain just in general. And that means that, I mean, it's never a magic carpet. And even compared to the Audi RS Q3, which we had through the garage at the same time, but we didn't do a direct comparison with, it definitely feels a bit firmer. But I, to really put this car through its paces over the recent long weekend, put four people, all of our stuff, a whole lot of food in the back. It was absolutely chockers. And with that much weight on board on pretty average country roads, I was expecting it to be really crashy and quite uncomfortable. But it genuinely was a comfortable cruiser, and I would very happily drive it every day. So I think it ticks the daily driving box a lot better than previous AMG stuff. Everything I've read and heard and experienced from the passenger seat in those previous cars is that they're just too firm. But combined with the fact it's got a bigger body, it's got a really usable boot, and it's got quite a high-tech interior, the ride means you could pretty happily drive this GLA 45 every day and not stress too much about it. You wouldn't need to go to the chiropractor weekly.
So you said before it pretty much feels like a rally car. Did you get a chance to take it through some twisties, and how did it handle those? If you
did? I did. So we got up early one morning on the long weekend, and we were staying on the Great Ocean Road. And I think the first thing that's worth pointing out is that for the first time in my life, people actually use the slow vehicle turnout. I don't know what it is about the GLA 45, but we came up behind people and they just got out of the way, which is really unusual and really courteous. So that's a big tick to Victorian motorists on that front. But yeah, when you flick the little dial into Sport Plus and you put it in manual mode and you really turn everything up, it's just like rabid or manic, or there's all sorts of words that we've thrown around. And the way that it kind of reels in the horizon is really, really impressive, because it's not... like, although it's quite loud and quite raucous and quite firm, it doesn't feel like there's a lot of fuss about it. You just kind of turn in, put your foot down, and it sort of sorts everything out underneath you, and you just disappear off onto the horizon. It's really, really impressive, but it's impressive in that it doesn't feel like you're miles detached from the experience, because that's often a criticism of cars that are rapidly quick, is that you don't feel like you're part of it. But the steering is quite heavy, and although you can feel what's going on underneath you, and there's really clever German computer stuff that couldn't possibly be explained to me if the Germans who designed it tried, going on to make you go quickly, the car feels like it wants to rotate when you get on the power. The back end feels like it wants to come round a little bit, and that's not something you can often say about all-wheel drive cars. But also just the speed you're doing and the way that it grips and you can use the power all the time means that you're focusing really hard and you can really extract a lot from it. So, yeah, I was really impressed. And I was really impressed with the way the car can be set up. I think one of the things that a lot of manufacturers do at the moment is they've got a sport mode or an eco mode, and it doesn't actually change all that much about the car, or it changes too much and you want to be able to pick and mix the best bits. With this Merc, what you can do is you can flick it into Sport Plus and then set the dampers to be in full comfort, the transmission to be in sport mode, and the exhaust to be in full race or something like that if you want to. And you can do it all using the really cool little screens that are actually on the steering wheel. So if you're in a hurry, and if you're flicking into Sport Plus, you probably are, you can flick to Sport Plus and then click a little toggle on the steering wheel and put the suspension in comfort. And all of a sudden, you've got everything in full angry mode, proper manual mode, which is awesome. It won't override you unless you actually take it out of manual with a button, which is rare. But also a car that can soak up the bumps better and doesn't feel like it's going to shake your teeth loose, which is kind of the point of these customizable cars. You want to be able to pick and mix and match and make them exactly what you want. And I think Mercedes, along with Hyundai, with its N system, is really at the forefront of allowing you to do that quickly on the fly and tailor the car to what you need.
Sounds like an actual practical driver's SUV, and Mercedes-Benz or AMG have done a really good job at doing this.
Yeah, I'm kind of I'm not used to saying lots of really nice things about cars because obviously we drive a lot of cars and our job is to work out what's right and what's wrong with them. And I mean, the GLA, it isn't perfect. It is very expensive. And I think also the interior, although it has a lot of really flashy tech in it, there are bits of it that you touch and you look at and they look very similar to what you get in a $50,000 A-Class, which is awesome if you're buying that $50,000 A-Class. But at nudging $120,000 once you start ticking options boxes, again, requires some getting your head around. So yeah. It's a bit of a confusing one in that it's an expensive car. It's based on pretty humble underpinnings. But then you put your foot down, you show it a set of corners, and the way that it just devours a road is so impressive. It's a confusing one, but I really liked it.
I'm happy to hear that it's a really good car because there's one thing that I haven't gotten a chance to get behind the wheel of one yet, but there's one thing I don't like about it, and it's the way it looks on the outside. The last GLA, it kind of just, it barely even looked like an SUV. It just looked like a hatch. It was a little higher. I think there was a different chrome bar in the back. I could barely tell the difference between it and an A45 MG. But this one, what do you think of the looks, Scully?
I am far from a fashion icon, so I don't know that you should take too much stock in what I'm saying here. But, yeah, I agree with you that the normal GLA looks a little bit like MPV-ish. There's almost a bit of previous Gen B class about it, and I don't know if that's a compliment in any form. But I do think that with all the AMG stuff on it, with the wide front bar, with the wing, with the big wheels, it's got a bit of presence about it, and it looks kind of fat and low on its wheels, which is a weird thing to say about an SUV, I realize. So I think the GLA is definitely the best-looking form of a car that can look a bit dull. But, yeah, I agree. Proportionally, it's not what you'd call particularly sexy.
Well, that's what I always found funny about the last GLA 45 is that it was a lowered version of a higher version of a hatchback. So it kind of went full circle.
There you go. That GLA 45 review is live at carexpert.com.au, so go and check it out. The 2021 Hyundai Kona isn't all new, but it's pretty close to it. New powertrains, a fresh look, updated tech. Here to tell us what it's like is Tony Crawford. Hello, Crawford.
Hey, guys. How are you? And yes, I actually own a Kona. Can I just put that out?
You do?
Straight up. It's a 2018 Highlander that I bought, and unfortunately it's been commandeered by my oldest daughter, so I no longer am in possession, physical possession of the car. But
what does she think of it?
She adores it. That was her pick. I put the Seltos out there before she needed the car, and I said, you've got to look at this. This is a great-looking car with more space. And anyway, it was just Kona, and I think a lot of people, well, clearly more than 40,000 people in the last 3 years have thought the same because that's how many they've sold, which made up a staggering 23% of all Hyundai's sales in Australia. I mean, that's not bad for a model that's only 3 years old. And if you look at the VFAX sales for small SUVs, last month it was number one by quite some margin, I think 1,780 something. Second highest was like, I don't know, 1,200, I think. Yeah. Mitsubishi ASX, you've got Seltos, did some pretty good numbers last month as well, but this month went back to about, I think, 785 or something like that. I actually think Seltos is a fantastic car, so Kona had a lot to live up to, and it's always been about the look and style of that car. And this mid-cycle facelift has only improved things pretty much in every regard. But, you know, like it's got more tech, so it's got, first of all, let's talk about the looks, because the front fascia of the car I really like, particularly the N-line version. So just to put that into some perspective, you can – the Kona comes in six variants, four of them being the base Kona, called Kona, and then the Active, and then the Elite, then the Highlander. They all come with a 2-litre naturally aspirated SmartStream four-cylinder engine, petrol engine. And you used to be able to get the Highlander, like my Highlander has a 1.6 turbo. Well, that engine is reserved wholly and exclusively for the N-line versions, which is the N-line and the N-line Premium. So they're the only cars that get that, and they're the only variants that get independent rear suspension. The The rest of the models, the rest of the variants are all on the torsion beam rear axle.
Hyundai has made some big changes on the outside. What has it done to the interior to make it feel more fresh? Because the pre-update car was starting to feel a little bit old, even though it's not actually what you'd call ancient by any standard.
No, but the tech felt a bit, had a very small screen in it, even the Highlander. And for some people, they may not care, but I like, you know, where everyone's doing big screens now. You only have to get into the Volkswagen Touareg to realize just how big your TV screen in your car can be, because it's pretty massive. But anyway, they've gone to a 8-inch for the base and the active, and then from the Elite up gets a 10.25-inch touchscreen infotainment display. That's really, really good. It'd be a reason I'd like to upgrade, to be honest, because that screen is fantastic. It's got quick response times. You also get in the Highlander, I think the Highlander, might be wrong there. I'm just wondering where that cuts in at the 10.25-inch digital driver's display. That's very good. It's very similar to what I drove in the i30 sedan recently. I reviewed that car, and that had the same, pretty much the same infotainment display and the driver's digital instrument display. And I really like those. We got used to those with Volkswagen product particularly, but now Hyundai's jumped on the bandwagon and putting it out there too. And it's good. The models below, I think the Elite, or I think it's the Elite actually that starts with that. And then the Active and the Kona, the base two models, they get the standard binnacles with a small 4.2-inch screen in the middle.
I believe the Highlander and the N-Line Premium get the digital instrument cluster, but the larger touchscreen comes in from Elite upwards.
Yeah, okay. Interestingly, they're the only two cars I drove, the Highlander and the N-Line Premium on the launch. Even though they had a few variants there, everyone didn't get a chance to cycle through everything. But look, it feels really fresh in there. I've always loved the fact that they have a very cool cabin. The seats are great. They're particularly good in the N-Line versions with sports seats and red piping and all that sort of stuff. But just back on the outside, because they've changed it's a bit of a different fascia from the Highlander to the N-Line. Certainly N-Line and N-Line Premium get these sort of fake vents at the front. And I kind of called them a bit Serene vents, because they kind of look like some really cool Italian. They don't work, of course, and they're filled up. And Bit Serene used two big air vents or intakes, and Hyundai have put three slots across the bonnet. But it looks really, really good the way they've done it, and the really nice, fantastic grey paint on this particular car that I've actually got now is just, I mean, they've really, it's a premium product and as far as that goes, but it does have some really nasty foibles that are really, really kind of ticking me off a little bit.
What are they?
For instance, up front is a single USB port, USB-A port of all things, and it's flanked by two 12-volt receptors. I mean, who uses, you know, 12? I thought they were redundant last century, essentially. And, I mean, why wouldn't you have used the update to, and I'm sure to replace 12 volts with USB-C, which most people are trying to do now and are doing, would be a pretty simple operation, but obviously not for Hyundai. Still got the old 12-volt big plugs that I haven't seen in, as I said, a decade. They've also omitted rear air vents. Now, obviously it was omitted before as well, but again, couldn't you take the time and the effort to put in rear air vents? And I mean,
all variants, Croft?
Yeah, I was just checked I had to recheck because I was actually staggered that this wasn't rectified in some way. And it's obviously a design thing. And, you know, the fact with that generation that with that car and on that platform, you just can't do it. I would have thought you'd go to the ends of the earth to put rear air vents for your kids on a hot day. But anyway, that's an omission. And, of course, the fact that you can't get a Highlander with a 1.6 turbo mated to you know, part-time all-wheel drive and a dual-clutch auto, you've got to go with the CVT. Now, is it any good, the CVT with the – because I was particularly horrified to learn that I wouldn't be able to, that I was going to be driving now in the Highlander, a 2-litre naturally aspirated thing, engine with, you know, with a CVT. But in actual fact, I was pleasantly surprised because there's a decent amount of poke. It's only got 110 kilowatts and 180 Newton meters. That's actually up, believe it or not, on the previous thing. And but it actually gets along really, really well. And that CVT, it's specially calibrated to mimic sort of eight step changes or eight gears. And it does a really good job of it. And I was really looking to dig into this car and really give it some mumbo, but and you know, really sort of downgrade it. But I kind of couldn't because it was really, really one of the best CVT pairings or marriages to a naturally aspirated engine that I've actually driven. Toyota do a pretty good job of it too. Kit-wise, it comes with a stack of kit. I mean, even the base version gets wireless CarPlay, Apple CarPlay and Android Auto, which is this is interesting too, by the way. The base model gets it, but the Highlander, of course, anything with a 10.25-inch screen doesn't get it. You get wired CarPlay and Android Auto. But you do get wireless charging across the range as well, and they have upped the safety slightly, so it's still a five-star safety rating from its 2017 ANCAP award, if you like, or test, and blind spot, although you don't get blind spot and rear cross traffic alert or assist unless you buy the top, I think it's the N-Line Premium. No, you do get blind spot assist and rear cross traffic alert and safe exit warning on the Elite from the Elite up.
Yeah.
But that's a fair bit. You get a Harman Kardon sound system from the Elite up as well. But I don't think you should panic if you can only afford the base model, because that 8-inch touchscreen infotainment system is pretty good compared to what it was. So if you were used to a smaller, the previous version I think was a 6 or 7-inch. It was definitely a lot smaller, and this feels classier and better. And
yeah. So we've been told by executives from Kia that the reason why the 8-inch screens without sat nav have wireless smartphone connectivity and the larger screens with sat nav don't is because Hyundai and Kia, like the Hyundai Motor Group, is having some kind of dispute with the tech giant. They wouldn't say who, but the gist of it is the tech giant wants their map to appear as the default. So yeah, it is really strange because now that this little variance is afflicting so many different Hyundai models, like the Venue and the Carnival, etc., you get a better feature with the worst screen. It's just strange.
Yeah, it is bizarre. It's something to do with a licensing fee for maps and them wanting to use their OEM mapping system. And it's all quite convoluted, and that doesn't help the buyer, of course.
A question for you, Croft, because I've driven the Seltos, and you mentioned that you were pushing your daughter to get a Seltos instead of a Kona instead. I was really impressed. I drove both the 2-liter and the 1.6-liter turbo Seltoses back to back, and I really came away impressed with the 2-liter because even though I'm not the biggest fan of CVTs, it drove really well.
Don't forget the Seltos 1.6. Before we go back to that, is also a lower power than this 146 kilowatt.
Yeah,
it's a 130, I think, and hopefully that'll be updated when the midlife cycle comes of Seltos.
And with the Seltos, they make you step all the way up to the Sport Plus or the GT line to get it. That was why I really liked the pre-update Kona, because even in the base Go, you could get the more powerful engine, all-wheel drive. I always thought that was good of Hyundai to do that, but now they've changed that, obviously.
They have changed it. And here's the other thing that really irks me. This is the big ticket item irk, if you like, that I want to call out in the Kona, and it's been there from day one, boot space. It used to have 361 litres, which is not big by any stretch. Now it's got 374. It's slightly long. I don't know how they've done this, because it's only longer because of a body kit. And I think there's 15 mils more rear legroom, I was told by the product guy. So it's still not enough. In actual fact, my daughter, her husband has to sit in the back seat with the baby because the front seat has to go so far forward to fit the rear-facing baby seat in that he can't sit in the front. There's just no room, and there's only room. I've seen her pram in there, and that's about all that fits, just the pram. So, you know, Seltos has got 433 litres behind the rear seats. You know, like it's literally, besides the CX-30 and CX-3, the Kona, new Kona, is probably one of the smallest luggage areas in segment. So that's, you know, that's a deal breaker for a lot of people. I know it's a cool looking car, and it's got some cracking features, and it goes well. It actually rides really well, good ride compliance. It handles really well, always has. Good steering response. It's quick ratio steering. I like everything about it, but the boot space is a deal breaker for a lot of people. And I'll put new mums definitely into that category. I would suggest that you look for a larger vehicle such as the Seltos. Yeah.
I suppose Hyundai really aren't targeting families for this car. It's more of a little city runabout or
but
a couple's car, isn't it?
I got it, you know, like with, I'll use my daughter as a prime example, you know, 28 years old, loves the car, loves the fact that it's an SUV as well, sits slightly higher, and didn't realise, and I did say, you know, check the, but, you know, the heart struck first, and she bought off looks and styling, and the fact that it, you know, the Highlander, as is now, comes with literally everything from heated and cooled seats. You name it, it's got it. It's literally got stuff that, you know, twice more expensive cars have got in terms of its feature list. That's where it's always been really strong, particularly at the higher end. But now I think Hyundai have really added value to the lower end models. And I think that's a good thing. Like, there's so much good stuff to like about this car, but I think the fact that it's misses out on rear air vents, it gets two USB ports, it gets, you know, bugger all room in the boot for some people that want to lug, you know, lifestyle stuff around, bikes, certainly bikes, surfboards and all that thing, you're going to be struggling. You might be right, Mandy, it's really for just couples. But, you know, good luck if you want to go, you know, mountain biking, that sort of stuff, you know.
Well, you can search Hyundai Kona up at carexpert.com.au to find out more. Thank you very much, Tony Crawford.
Thanks, guys.
There goes another episode of the Car Expert podcast. What's coming up on the site over the next week, Scully?
So as we're recording this, it's Thursday night in Melbourne. On Friday, the Hyundai Kona review we talked about today, and also Kurt's review of the Skoda Kamiq 110 TSI with the bigger four-cylinder engine will be live. And then over the weekend, we're actually running a review of the Hyundai Tucson Hybrid out of Europe. That's the new, really sharp-looking car that will be arriving in Australia later this year. Very keen to see what our overseas contributors think of that, because it looks awesome on paper. And then Monday, as the podcast goes live, we have a Toyota Camry Ascent Sport Hybrid review written by yours truly. Spoiler alert, it is the only car you would ever need. It's incredibly good and it only costs $32,000. I can't believe when people don't buy that car.
And Will, what cars are we going to see in our garages next week?
Well, I hope y'all like pickup trucks. Malcolm has a lot of them. So we've got down in Melbourne a SsangYong Musso XLV. It's a long wheelbase version. We've got the new GWM Ute. We've got, well, speaking of Ford Ranger Raptors again, we've got one of those. We've also got a Jeep Gladiator. And perhaps the antithesis to all those models, we've got a couple of Germans. So a BMW 520i. And a Mercedes-Benz A250 sedan. In Sydney, we've got Croft behind the wheel of a Skoda Scala Monte Carlo. Oh, I mean, I think he was just saying on last week's podcast he really wanted to get behind the wheel of a Monte Carlo.
Yeah.
I wish already. And also a Toyota Supra GTS. And up here in Brisbane, Bors is driving a BMW X5 M50i xDrive. And I'll be getting behind the wheel of the new Kia Sorento. And it'll be the first time I think any of us on staff have gotten a chance to drive the V6. So we've had reviews of various diesel models in the range. This will be my chance to get behind the wheel of the front-wheel drive V6 model. And also, we've got a GWM Ute up here, just so I can see what it's like, considering I've been through so many Utes lately.
Tell you what, I've seen a few of those new Sorentos getting out and about on the road. They've got a fair amount of presence, don't they? They're quite unique styling. I quite like them.
They look really nice. And in January, they rocketed up to, I believe, second in the segment in sales. Yeah. So people, other people think they look nice too, evidently.
Yes, definitely. All right, that's an end. As always, our email, if you would like to hear from us, podcast@carexpert.com.au. Actually, we would like to hear from you, rather. Thank you so much, Scott Colley and William Stopford. Cheers.
Thanks, Mandy.
Thanks, Mandy.